thanks to all of you for coming along this afternoon. It's always a bit of an odd slot to be in the last one of the day. I shall try and keep this as mercifully short as I can, but still keep it informative, hopefully informative. My name's Hugh Blemings, as I guess you'll see on the early slide. I've been working on free software for quite some time now, and it's been my profession since 1997. I've actually just finished a stint with IBM, 7 very enjoyable years. I'm currently quite enjoying being an unemployed bum. I commend it to you at some point. I guess what this talk's about is I've been fortunate enough to work with some quite a bright team of very experienced free and open source software hackers, kernel guys in particular, with the team at OzLabs. And having done some certain amount of development work myself, very much as a journeyman or a beginner, when I started out, I guess what I've tried to do in this talk is collect together the things I saw my friends and colleagues doing that just made them that much more efficient. We're sort of fortunate that free software development's come quite a long way in terms of lowering barriers of entry to at least get started. But what I've tried to capture in this talk is things that I've either done myself or more often than not observed my colleagues doing that just makes them that much more efficient. This is a point I'm particularly keen to make. I'm certainly not claiming to be a clever person myself, but I've just happened to have worked with a number of them over the years. Suggestions are certainly welcome at any time. I've given this variance on this talk a couple of times now. I guess this will probably be the last time I do it, but each time one of the really enjoyable things about it has been suggestions I've actually had from the audience, so it's kind of hopefully got a little bit better as time has gone on as a result. In terms of topics, the team I was working with and certain my overall background has very much been on the hardware and low-level sort of side of things, so we'll talk initially about some observations on how to set up hardware efficiently to allow development, remote debugging, particularly if you're doing bring up and those sorts of activities. Talk a bit about actually getting the kernel running, not necessarily super detailed stuff, but again just things that have proven to be quite efficient for us in the past. Talk about building kernels, and then the random data points, even though it's only sort of the last bullet there on the introduction, actually it probably is about a third of the talk in total, because these are just the random hints and tips that we've come across over the time. It wouldn't be a technical talk without having a picture. This is part of the hardware lab at my old office. I realised after I committed to doing this talk that now that I'm no longer an IBM employee, I perhaps shouldn't be showing photos of IBM equipment, but anyway, we'll deal with that if they send the lawyers around. Our group did a lot of work on embedded devices, so this is obviously hardware to support bringing up embedded boards, and in particular what we have that I wanted to call out on this frame is obviously an embedded board, in this case for an IBM PowerPC 440 part or AMCC 440 part, but you notice there's sort of brown wire sort of disappearing off down below. Basically that allowed us to do some useful things hardware-wise with the board. We've got Ethernet and serial ports all configured up, and an in-circuit emulator. If I go back to the previous frame, the unit down the bottom is a serial concentrator, a little bit more about that in a moment, an Ethernet switch, and then a couple of relay boards, which is where what allowed us to work on this hardware efficiently remotely. So just to get a bit of a sense of who I'm dealing with, how many of you in the audience are involved with sort of embedded hardware debugging or development? Two. How about people doing sort of chip level stuff of any kind? Exactly, not one. Good, thank you. Thank you for coming. So one of the first things that we strike when we're doing bring up, so this is getting, by bring up we mean getting Linux booting on a piece of hardware or on a chip that's never run Linux before. One of the first things we strike is, of course, it's going to take a while to get, it's going to be a very iterative process, so having the ability to remotely reset and remotely control the power on these sorts of boards is enormously useful. If your own activities are more confined to, I guess, more traditional hardware, PC hardware, that sort of thing, these sorts of techniques can still be useful. Being able to remote power cycle equipment in a colo is an obvious thing, but even if you're doing development yourself, it can just save you that extra step of walking into the next room to reset a machine. If you're doing PC hardware though, there's some other techniques you can use that obviate the need for this direct hardware support. So remote reset, remote power controller, I guess are two hardware things that we found very useful in the lab to enable us to do this, bring up work very efficiently. Cereal concentrators is basically a rack-mounted unit. The particular one we've had experience with is made by an Australian company called Open Gear. I don't get any commission, but we've just used their kit and it works pretty well. But it essentially allows you to SSH to a serial port, a physical serial port, and in this case it has 48 of them. So we're able to connect to the serial consoles on the various embedded boards of the entire lab, quite a number of machines through one physical box. Ethernet hubs and switches with a monitor, or Ethernet hub or switches with a monitoring port. One of the things you'll be striking again and again if you're doing the early bring-up side of things is dealing with Ethernet devices that perhaps aren't working properly, or you're in the process of initialising them, and then later on having to actually TFTP or otherwise or load firmware up to them. Ethernet hubs, although they're kind of out of fashion nowadays as the backbone for your network, still have that unique characteristic that each port sees the traffic on all the other ports, making it that being the main distinction between a hub and a switch. While that tends to be a nuisance on a congested network. Sorry, Julian, yes? Well, that's kind of what I was leaning to. If you've got an old hub lurking around, don't throw it out, because it can be quite useful for this activity. Many modern switches, though, it tends to be the more sophisticated ones that have inbuilt management, will actually allow you to say, I want all the traffic that goes to port 2 to also be seen on port 3 or on a particular monitoring port. So that's sort of the tap kind of technique, I guess. Not all... Sorry? Okay, sorry, my mistake. Yeah, so mirroring seems to be fairly common, but only on switches that have got management, whereas if you bought, as I did, a cheaper switch for home, that won't necessarily give that ability. So having a hub floating around is still quite a useful thing. One of the things we observed, particularly with embedded boards, was that often the onboard firmware may be a little bit immature or simple, and one of the things we identified is if you have that sitting on a very busy Ethernet, you can actually get a whole raft of problems from there with firmware locking up and these sorts of things. So quite often, if you're doing this sort of low-level embedded work, it's useful to actually have that hardware sitting on a physically separate Ethernet segment to everything else, just so it doesn't see all the other traffic. Hence the observation that some firmware has broken TFTP or DHCP support, and sometimes it can behave badly when it's on a busy LAN. In-circuit debuggers are pretty unique to the embedded society things, I guess, and are fairly specialised, but it's the sort of hardware, if you have access to them, can simplify that process of early bring-up enormously. So move on to early bring-up techniques. It's becoming increasingly common to use simulation environment. Some of these are very, very sophisticated. At IBM, we were able to enjoy access to cycle-accurate software-based simulators, so we could actually play with chips before they were physically instantiated in hardware at all. For those of us working at home, though, or perhaps working on Intel or other more common hardware, QEMU and other free emulators can be very, very useful as well, because they'll give you, won't necessarily give you cycle accuracy, but they do give you an environment that, from a software standpoint, looks very much like the real thing. One of my colleagues, Sonny Rao, will be giving a talk tomorrow afternoon on adventures around bare metal Linux, which I commend to you, but a lot of what Sonny's actually going to be talking about is this next bullet point, which is the fact that new hardware can have some interesting features. Sometimes memory controllers don't work on those sorts of things, for example, so our team at various points had to deal with chips that didn't have fully functioning memory controllers and they were able to employ various techniques to, for instance, load a kernel directly into cache and execute directly out of cache rather than out of main memory. The sort of thing that became handy there, I believe this code's now in mainline, is often if you're dealing with hardware that's either in a simulation environment or doesn't have access to working I/O hardware, it can be useful to run a console in memory rather than actually through a physical port. So in this particular case, the console information is written to a particular area of physical memory address region. You actually interact with the upcoming kernel through that. Device numbering is a bit of a knotty topic. What we found pretty consistently with embedded hardware is that the chips will consider an Ethernet port to be called, say, EMAC 2 and EMAC 3. This is in the example of the 440 parts, for example. Linux, in turn, is going to label that ETH 0 and ETH 1. And I was tremendously embarrassed that through a mixture of sort of being half asleep and some strange PCB numbering, that I was trying to debug a problem with Ethernet and I wasn't actually physically plugged into that port at all. So that's another one to watch out for. In the kernel running, this is pretty pretty specific, I guess, to working on, working on embedded hardware, but if you're ever of a mind to get into repurposing routers and things like that, devices that can run Linux but don't presently, some of these supports could well be useful to you there. Most of the commonly supported architectures have a fairly standard bootloader process. U-boot is a very common one in the PowerPC side of things. If you're working with Intel chips, you're almost invariably going to be dealing with a fairly standard sort of BIOS environment. That's not to say that the kernel is necessarily reliant on that, and particularly on the PowerPC side of things, the kernel can actually boot pretty much from scratch, by which we mean either using a JTAG or some sort of other in-circuit emulation technique to actually physically to move the kernel image physically into memory and then just pointing the program counter and having it run from there. So you don't necessarily need a bootloader in order to actually boot or get the kernel running. There's some further gotchas with that though. Quite often the onboard firmware, whether it be on power or any sort of embedded hardware, the firmware will actually often initialize serial ports itself, but then Linux will come along and reinitialize those, and we've got caught out a number of times where things seem to be working, getting a whole bunch of boot messages from the firmware, then as soon as the firmware calls the kernel, everything stops. And actually the kernel was quite happily running, but the kernel had done some serial port reinitialization and console was being directed out to another physical port that wasn't tapped out on that particular board. I spent half an hour one morning trying to work out why I wasn't getting debug messages from a kernel because I hadn't put debug on the command line, so a trap for young players there. So moving away from embedded hardware and so the low level side of things, just to talk a bit about some tools that we're using in the lab. Git's obviously pretty much the tool of choice now for manipulating kernel source trees. I don't propose to give a detailed Git tutorial here. But there are a number out there on the web. Getting current trees and generally manipulating source trees, has its own ways of dealing with that. But I commend Matt McCall's Ketchup utilities too as well. They're quite a nice way to interact with Git and conventional tarball-based source trees. First little thing I wanted to demo, again, just to provide some examples and then sort of play with it or go from there, is a tool called GitK, which is actually written by one of my colleagues, Paul McCarris. And just hopefully successfully switch terminals. So GitK is basically a tool that allows you to do some visualization of Git commits. Down on the side here, on the left-hand side of the screen, you can see what the beginnings of a directed acyclic graph, which basically, if you follow it all the way down, you can actually see a visual representation of where the different merges and commits lead. Running through a GitK would be almost an entire session itself, so I'll just do some quick, so obvious things. One of the devices, I recently did a very minor change to the kernel just to update the credits file, for example. And if we type that in, it'll go ahead and search, and it'll pull out the first match for my name. Not rocket science, but if you prefer GUI tools, it can be quite a nice way to operate. As you can see here, this is unfortunately a relatively low-res screen I'm working on in front of me, but there's information about the different commits and a whole bunch of information made available to you there in a visual sort of form. Another tool that was pointed out to me literally on the bus on the first day of the conference is one called TIG, or Git backwards. Andrew, and I'm embarrassed I've forgotten his surname, talked about it at great length, much of which went over me, but it's very similar to GitK conceptually, but it's more of a text-based sort of tool. But again, it allows you that same sort of thing of being able to visualize commits, look at histories. If I can type one-handed. No match. I should point out, you'll notice in the bottom right, it's incrementing up. I'm actually running this on a Dell Mini 9, which is a really nice machine. Its electrical power is very low, so is its performance, relatively speaking. So please don't sort of infer that these tools are horribly inefficient. It's just a very modest processor that it's being run on. So we may not even worry about letting that complete. No, it's the commit I'm looking for is further down that search. We shan't wait for it. But yes, I said TIG is another tool that's worth having a look at if you want to look at other tools now. We've got up to. So a couple more things with Git, and Git bisect is becoming better known, I guess, but one of the things that our team spent a lot of time doing working on the PowerPC side of the kernel as we did was obviously finding bugs and correcting bugs, none of them ones we made ourselves, of course, but those of others. Git bisect's quite a nice tool. Basically what it lets you do is do binary searches through the kernel tree. So you give tell Git you want to start a bisection process, give it a good and a bad commit reference, build a resulting kernel, then once, depending on whether that kernel exhibits the bug or not, you can either say git bisect good, git bisect bad, and repeat that process. And what that allows you to do is, sorry, please. You're telling the bisect process that particular kernel was good. So next time you do a bisect, it'll find another midway point on the right. So whatever you decide is the right or wrong. I'm sorry. Yeah, beg your pardon. Yes, indeed it does. So the git bisect good at that point will then give you a new, or take the tree to another reference point, depending on whether it was good or. Yep. What you can do with that is do a binary tree search through the kernel and very quickly arrive at the point where you find the problem in question. The last command there resets the process. The thing that's significant with this is it can be very readily automated, and we actually got to the point where we could do quite a lot of our PowerPC kernel architecture tests pretty much fully automatically by automating the build process, giving it some start and end points, and we actually build a kernel, run it out to a piece of hardware, see if the fault was exhibited or not, and narrowed down to a very small range of patches or commits that that caused the problem. Unfortunately, it's a long time since I've personally done kernel hacking. I guess it's 3 or 4 months now, if not more. Qt was a tool that was in very common use in the lab. It's got a fairly modest learning curve, and trying to do a tutorial would pretty much be a whole session in itself. But Qt essentially helps you automate that process of keeping kernel trees and keeping your changes, patches. And again, looking at the way my colleagues tended to work, that this idea or concept of keeping your work as patches rather than as complete trees was a fairly pretty much a universal way of operating for the guys on the team. So the combination of Qt, Git, and keeping it works as patches basically made that process of tracking a mainline kernel much, much easier. So rather than having sort of your tree and mainline and continually having to do diffs and work backwards and forwards between them, if you implicitly kept your work as patches when mainline was updated, it was a much easier process to update your tree, incorporate your patches and go from there. One of my first memories of seeing Rusty Russell at work was the great ease with which he seemed to jump around the kernel tree. A certain amount of that is undoubtedly Rusty being quite a clever chap, but he had another tool in his arsenal which I quickly sort of added to mine. There's an option within the kernel to build tags files. Tags files allow your favourite editor, Emacs or Vi as it might be, to have a concept of where functions and other particular keywords are within the kernel. So for example, I've started Emacs up on here because it takes about 15 minutes otherwise. But if I wanted to look at where the keyspan initialization function, keyspan makes some serial to a USB to serial adapters that I did some drivers for a long time ago. It asks me what tags file I want to visit, and it's called tags, all cap by default. It's big. It's going to take a moment to think about that. La-da-da-da, no, didn't need to sing. Jumps you straight to the function. Okay, so that's sort of handy, but I'm interested in what's in this USB serial register function. Again, I can just do a meta full stop. It's picked up down the bottom there, it's picked up that I've got it, or the cursor is actually sitting on a particular function. It'll go off and find that, and you can basically jump around the kernel much more quickly than you would otherwise, and you don't necessarily need to have the whole kernel headers and sort of layout of the kernel stuck in or in the back of your mind. Again, we can do another search, and it's just basically a quick way to jump around the kernel source. It works on functions, it works on prototypes, on type definitions, structures, so on and so forth. And there's also some similar tools. I've not used them myself, but there's some similar tools there now for integrating that same CTags kind of functionality into GUI, so you can kind of get that same Eclipse-like integration. Another tool that got a lot of use back in the office is one called Dirtdiff, which is actually written by one of our colleagues. And what I've got, for the sake of this example, is a current upstream tree and an older 2.6.20.24 tree. If we run Dirtdiff on that, Dirtdiff's in Debian and most common patches, it'll actually go through and do a visual diff of all the files that have changed between those two versions. We can look in Sequoia board, why not, if I can drive a mouse. And basically gives you a visual representation of what's changed between those two files. You can actually then, if you so wish, select lines that you want to update one file from the other. It just provides a nice visual interface for doing quickly visualising changes and moving those changes backwards and forwards. I'll talk a little bit about building kernels. Building kernels is something we did quite a lot of in OzLabs and continue to this day. I guess the general point here is, though, is if you're working on kernel, or equally if you're working on X or OpenOffice or anything like that, you're going to be rebuilding it quite a bit. So you probably want to try and make it as quick as possible. The approach vendors would like you to take is by a honking big compile box. I still quite like IBM, so I quite happily recommend the P595. That's a 64-way power 6. It can build about 3 kernels per second, so you don't really have to wait for that puppy too much. Unfortunately, we didn't actually have one in the lab. We had similar hardware, but not quite that quick. So, for those of us that have, like me, have much more modest budgets, there's 3 tools I just wanted to talk about real quick. Ccache is a nice little bit of code. Apt-get install ccache, or just grab it straight out of your favourite distro. But essentially, what ccache does is inserts itself or replaces the compilers and make and a few other tools on your system with it. And when you do a compile, ccache looks at the arguments and basically caches the results. It uses a mixture of checksumming and date stamps and so forth to assess whether a file needs to be rebuilt. But essentially what it amounts to is it's a bit like a web cache but for object files. So if you try and compile something you've already compiled, it'll actually just return that object file out of cache directly rather than going through the process of recompiling things. Now that go ahead, Julian, please. Oh, okay. Well, buying faster disk will certainly help, but ccache will catch a lot of stuff that make won't necessarily correctly deal with. But it's one of the things I guess I liked about ccache is it's one of those ones where you can pretty much just install it and forget, and you get the speed ups more or less for free. DiskCC was the next stop along the way. DiskCC, as the name suggests, does distributed C compiles. Again, that's one of the things that's nice about it is it's pretty easy to set up. It does rely on you having if you're doing cross-compilation, for example, you need to have the relevant cross-compilers installed on the other boxes in the farm. But it's a very easy to set up distributed compile environment. Doing distributed compiles may sound a little bit exotic. I think it's fair to say that most of us do have more than one machine at home. My daughter's system quite often gets pressed into service, and she's blissfully unaware of it, in order to help me compile up kernels, as does our main server. So one of its real strengths is it's very easy to get going. Last but no means least is C-Control, which is, I guess, a wrapper, a GUI wrapper or GUI environment that lets you sort of control and monitor both the operation of both of those. They're all pretty easy to get going, and I would certainly commend them to you. Just a few other sort of random data points, I guess, on the building kernels side of things. This one will be obvious to anyone who's done sort of kernel work for any length of time, but it was an eye-opener for me the first time I was told about it, just basically being able to put all the binary stuff for the kernel somewhere else so you don't clutter up your trees. There's a few other tips there. These are the slides, so this will be made available, but essentially just different ways of improving or speeding up the process. So now move into some, I guess, random data points, just some general tools that have found useful. The first few are a couple called iPrint and Bitfield. The iPrint, if we can change consoles. So I's not exactly complicated. Won't change the world, but it does save you having to keep an ASCII conversion table sitting on your desk. But basically, you can feed it any combination of bits, hexadecimal, ASCII, etc., and it'll just give you a representation back. A bit more useful, though, is another utility called Bitfield, Thanks, Rusty. Is that what you had in mind? You know, I'm going to be thinking about that for the rest of the evening now. right, Bitfield is another nice little utility that the guys use a lot in lab, written by Jeremy Kerr and with some help from Michael Newling. Basically, what it does is allows you to feed a register definition. In this case, it's the PowerPC main status register, and a hexadecimal string to say what its current status is, and it breaks that out so you can actually see what the different bits mean. It's kind of handy if you're in that situation where you're dealing with a crash dump in one screen and have a working console on some other machine, you can actually see what's gone on. If my memory serves me correctly, -L. So on Bitfield-L, it will tell you what registers it knows about. It's pretty PowerPC-centric at the moment, but I spoke with Mark Gross from Intel, and he was considering working out taking the definition files they use for the various Intel chips and adding support for that. It's all extensible. There's a system-wide file you can use to add your own extensions to Bitfield to add support for your favourite chip. So the question is, what's the package for Debian? It's not actually installed, but if you do a Google search on Bitfield and Jeremy, that will take you to Jeremy's website, and you can find it from digging around through there. There's a Debian package is available for it. Right, bash stuff. Okay. So sorry, fumble fingers. Just some other little some tips. This time, just Bash, Bash related. Well, I guess Bash, as you may or may not be aware, has tab completion as a fairly standard feature now. If you look in Bash tab completion, there's a file there that actually has all the system-wide definitions. But what it essentially lets you do is things like say apt-get cache search foo. It's not going to work. Thanks. And on a faster computer, it'd be done before it was beer time. I'm driving this wrong. I'm sorry? It doesn't now. I'm install. But basically, it will let you. So there it's gone ahead and queried the apt database and given me a match for all the possible completions for apt-get install tux, which we won't worry about doing in this instance. The bash completion also knows about how to deal with makefiles, so in this directory. I've got a trivial program. If I can type make, and it'll go ahead and give me the different options that are available, what make can basically do with the make file in the current directory. That can be particularly useful on the kernel side of things too, because the kernel's got a pretty rich or complicated make file, and it will let you do a similar sort of thing. Favourite of mine though is if you, which I suspect I'm not going to be able to demonstrate. So the network, the demo gods are working against me rather badly by the looks of it. I haven't got network access here at the moment for some reason, but that same bash tab completion will actually work with SCP. So if you're in a situation where you have your public key set up on the remote box, you can actually do SCP file name, then a remote host, and it will actually go out to the network and give you directory completion off the remote machine. But I'm blowed if I know why my networking is not working. Can look inside tables as well, which is handy. And the final point there is a pretty straightforward one, but if you're using rsync or something else that's got about a million different options and very long command parameters, and you get to the end of it and realise you've got to change your mind, go back to the start, put a hash in front of it, hit enter, and it'll still be in your history, even though you won't have actually executed it. FDupes. Dupes is another nice one. Basically, it's one of those utilities that may not change the world. I have a slightly disorganised photo collection. FDupes is basically a program that finds and reports duplicate files. And it's pretty canny about it. It does matching on the basis of file names, but it also does MD5 sums over the files, so it will actually catch duplicates where in the situation where the file name is changed. So if we run fdupes-r for recurse on the current directory, it will go ahead and tell me that there's various cases where I've actually got the same file now in two directories. It's really useful. I find it very useful for keeping your photo directory in order, but it's also a sort of tool that with careful use you can use it to help tame your source code trees to see where the files really have changed. And of course in combination with xargs you can start automating things. So if you actually want to remove duplicates, you can pipe it through xargs and actually remove things automatically. Of course if you get it wrong you can also remove your entire home directory, so there is a reason for a degree of caution with that. So SSH, I was hoping to demonstrate some of these, but in the absence of a network, I'm going to be a little bit stuck, so we shall just press on. SSH is a tool that I guess we pretty much all know and love and use it quite a lot, or quite extensively. The demonstration I was hoping to do was to log into a machine at home and run an X11 VNC session over it, but the main reason I'm going to call SSH out separately in the first instance is just to remind people that modern SSH, since about version 2.1, 2.2 onwards, I think, has pretty extensive tools in terms of actually setting up doing not just forwarding by a port, but you can actually do entire sort of VPN-style port forwarding with modern SSH. LSOF, another useful tool, everything from pointing LSOF at your audio device to work out why you're not getting sound output, running it to look at what network sockets are open on your machine to see if something's happening which it shouldn't, or otherwise debug networking problems. X11 VNC was the one I really wanted to demonstrate, but I don't think it's going to happen, so we'll press on without. X11 VNC, you'd all be familiar, I imagine, with VNC, the ability to run remote desktops. What's nice about X11 VNC is, properly set up and assuming you have appropriate access to a remote machine, you can actually attach a VNC session to an existing X11 session. When I did this presentation in Ottawa earlier in the year, I had the classic domestic sort of tech support question from my sister that Thunderbird was no longer working, I really need my email. What can you do about it? And of course I'm on a plane, so not terribly much at the time. But using X11 VNC, what I was actually able to do is arrange for her to leave her system on, log into it remotely, and because the problem she was having was a GUI related one, changing some settings in in a GUI application that really the only way I was going to be able to debug it remotely was being able to do that. The X11 VNC web page has in the main man page basically all you need recipe-wise in order to do that, and assume you can get SSH access to the remote machine, you can go right in there and debug it. I just apologise, I was going to demonstrate it on my daughter's machine, but in the absence of network, that's not going to work. Screen is, I guess, the text equivalent of X11 VNC in many ways, in that it's, but it goes a little further than that. Screen essentially allows you to log into a remote machine, run it, and leave a number of TDY sessions running, and then log out. That can be useful for, shared attached. Two users, you can do two users and so forth at the same time. You can use it in a, it's really good over slow and unreliable links. You can log into a remote machine, run screen, and work in that sort of environment. If you inadvertently get disconnected, whatever you're working on will continue to run in your absence, and you can log back into that and get access to it. That can be, as I said there in the slides, can be very good for over slow and unreliable links. But another suggestion that was made was that can be really good for doing builds on embedded systems or otherwise systems that run very, very slowly. Quite often the build files and the make files themselves aren't set up to cope terribly well with you disconnecting. So if you run them in a screen session, you can kind of leave them running and go off and do something else, or disconnect and let it run overnight. Kevin Pulo is running a talk on LD preload hacks tomorrow. I won't elaborate beyond there, other than to say it's certainly particularly when Tridge is around, so LD preload seems to get quite a workout. We use it for everything, for getting around annoying proprietary software tendencies, to TiVo hacking back in the day, all sorts of different things. So I'd commend Kevin's talk to you if you're not able to get to it. It's certainly a technique that's worth learning. Essentially, in brief, what LD preload allows you to do is write your own function to intercept normal function calls on the system. So if you want to capture all the opens on a running application, that gives you a means to be able to do that. That's the thing. Some useful code snippets. Tridge's junk code directory is pretty cool. Always worth a bit of a look. And Rusty kicked off a project called CCAN, which is essentially intended to be to see what CPAN is to Perl. Still in its early stages, but if you're looking for that little bit of code for do something, there's a couple of resources there to take a look at. Just to wrap up, some random quotes. As I said, I solicited these from a few different people. Paul's one's first, but while I said it a little bit tongue-in-cheek, his real point was, as a developer community, don't assume people won't help you. Indeed, his point was really trying to assume the other way around, particularly within the kernel community. People are always happy to help, so please ask a question. I shan't read Tridge's out, but there's a good point there, dealing with files in particular in this case, but as just as a general programming idiom, consider whether you really need to test things or whether you can just rely on the results of the function you're calling. And the final one is provided by Greg Crowharman with his permission, needs no further observation. That's all I had prepared. I'm happy to field questions. Wow, that was quick. Please. Not so much a question, comment. You said that using XVNC, also just using SSH, -X object to export your display variable across your XVNC session. Yep.
You can run NX
on that. Good point. Okay.
Yeah.
No, thank you for that. I'll play with that and add it into the mix. Any other questions or suggestions? All right, well, I'm sorry I wasn't able to demonstrate the network. Oh, sorry, I beg your pardon, please. No, I don't. Okay, so the comment was, correct me if I'm wrong, but was it ACK, did you say? ACK? ACK, so a replacement for grep that's source code aware, so I won't traverse into .cvs directories and do those sorts of things. Thanks for that. Any others, questions, suggestions? All right, well, thank you again for your attention and enjoy the rest of the conference.